From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Dozens of activists are getting arrested in Portland, Oregon, seemingly every night, as protests against police brutality continue. Days after a right-wing Trump supporter was fatally shot in Portland, the city has been pinpointed by the Trump administration as indicative of the breakdown in law and order plaguing Democrat-run cities. Even though Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler is the target of protesters who are demanding that he resign, Trump now says he plans to cut off federal funding to Portland and other cities. We go to Portland to speak with Shane Burley, writer and filmmaker, whose work has appeared in Roar magazine, In These Times, Labor Notes, and Makeshift. He's the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. We spoke with him just a few weeks ago. Welcome back, Shane.
Thanks for having me back.
So the last time we spoke, it was around the presence of federal officers in Portland acting as a sort of unaccountable federal law enforcement, almost military-like presence that garnered huge outrage around the country. Right now, we hear that those officers have pulled back, but the Trump administration sort of threatens to keep bringing them back. Before we go to what's happening there, give us a sense of what is actually happening in Portland. We're reading a lot about it outside Portland, but as someone in the city, what's happening?
So I believe that September 3rd will be day 98. So it's been consistent protests for over 3 months now. And like you mentioned, federal officers have been brought in, particularly when the protests were centered on a federal justice center. And eventually, you know, state officials negotiated a withdrawal of those federal officers. But basically what they did was offer a devil's bargain of basically using aggressive local police to do the same thing that the federal officers were doing. So now the protests have continued. They've started to move around the city and target different police precincts and the police union office. And then Portland police have been incredibly heavy-handed like they were before, but maybe even especially so now, particularly the use of like hand-to-hand combat methods, using police batons, hitting protesters, that kind of thing.
And in fact, for our TV audience right now, we're watching one video that was just captured recently where a police officer broke the line of his own officers to run ahead. He seemed to want to target one particular protester and, you know, jumps on him and repeatedly punches him while other officers climb onto the same protester and help beat him up, essentially. So yes, we're seeing this huge amount of violence. Do you think it's gotten worse? Have the Portland police been emboldened by the recent federal officers' presence?
Yeah, I believe so. I think they're also emboldened by a certain right-wing media sphere and Trump's talking points suggesting that protesters are responsible for these massive acts of violence, which is, you know, disproportionately done by the police. In any of these situations, protesters are certainly engaging in lawlessness, I guess, you know, vandalism, setting trash fires, things like that. The police are responding with aggressive beating of protesters. And this is happening almost nightly.
What are the protesters demanding now? I mean, this was a protest that began around the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, obviously reflecting the local dynamics of police presence. Portland is a largely white city, although it is a very liberal city. It does have a history of racism. Has it now turned into protesters protesting police who keep attacking them, that then generates more protest and an ongoing cycle?
Yeah. So, I mean, Portland is a largely white city, but these protests are not like monolithically white. There's a really large presence of communities of color at the protests and in leadership of organizations around the protests. I mean, one of the things is that the behavior of Portland police and the federal officers, but largely Portland police, has made the point for protesters that the police are maybe an unreformable institution, that there's something really rotten at the core, that they are engaging in violence at a systemic level, and they make that point nightly with the way they're handling it. So in any given social movement, over time, things tend to moderate, people make compromises, they look at policy things. That has not happened here because the protesters are being beaten every single night. And so the demand up there is total police abolition. It's not moving from that line. The more moderate approach is to defund the police $50 million a year until they're is no police budget. That is the slightly more conservative branch of the protest on the ground.
Wow.
So right now, it's a complete total stalemate between protesters and the police.
What is happening with Mayor Ted Wheeler? The right-wing media is jumping on the fact that he has announced he will be moving from his apartment building because protests have basically dogged him at his residence, and they're seizing that as evidence of the violence of protesters.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Wheeler has been really unpopular from the right wing. This has happened for years. He's been very unpopular with the kind of far right groups that have been coming to Portland over the last few years to do rallies. He's also very, very unpopular with the left. A number of progressive organizations are now calling him for him to resign. So basically, he moved out of his condo, his expensive condo, because there's protests there, and moved to one of his other properties. He's a wealthy man. And so he's sort of getting it from all angles at this point. He is the kind of buck stops with him when it comes to the police. He sort of is the person in charge of the Portland police. And so he holds a great deal of responsibility. So even when he does these performative acts, like he comes out to the protest and they get tear gas, he has done very little to stop the police. And in fact, he's really using a law and order kind of perspective now after this killing from the other night to increase, deputization of federal officers for the dealing with the protesters in town.
Let's talk about the killing and what actually went on ahead of it. So in addition to the police having this heavy presence, acting violently, you've had a surge of Trump supporters. Is this a new aspect of protests? These counter-protesters are showing up. And where are these protesters coming from? Are they local or are they coming from outside?
Yeah, so the first thing is that it'd be really hard to characterize them as Trump supporters. People have worked really hard to characterize them as that. These are largely people associated with actual far-right organizations, Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys, militia organizations. This is not just like a GOP event. These are far-right organizations.
So you see those two as distinct still?
Maybe not ideologically and performatively, but in the media, they want to make the point that these are Trump supporters. And by saying that, suggesting these are just conservatives and they're having an ideological disagreement, but that's not what's happening. These are threatening organizations, people coming in and that have engaged in violence in the past. And we're engaging in violence that night. So we're talking about people doing a caravan through town and macing protesters, shooting them with frozen paintballs and things like that. These are not folks largely from the city. They're oftentimes people from surrounding areas, so maybe other parts of Oregon, which are largely rural, or across the river in Washington. That's certainly where Patriot Prayer comes from, which is largely over the river. And so what happened that night was there was a sort of like a caravan. So people are going to drive through town with American flags and Trump flags and things like that. And then started having conflicts with protesters because they went kind of off track on the caravan and went directly into where Black Lives Matter protesters were. Just about a week before that, there had been this Back the Blue rally organized by Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer and others, where essentially they just came to downtown Portland and attacked Black Lives Matter protesters with shields and batons, and some of them carried guns and things like that. So this is in the sequence of those sorts of things. And so there was a shooting of a Patriot Prayer associate downtown amidst this caravan. I think they're still not sure exactly what happened, but it was likely a conflict resulting from whatever was happening with the convoy.
So is it fair to suggest that this killing indicates or might indicate that protesters among Black Lives Matter activists might be starting to arm themselves? Or is that too far a leap?
I think it'd be too far of a leap. I haven't seen anything indicating that protesters arm themselves on any regular basis. In fact, people generally discourage that kind of thing, even when they might encourage, self-defense and other parameters, because it escalates the situation and, can get you charges from the police. It's just not a great idea. So I don't think that that's been the case. That being said, people are very, very scared. And the Proud Boys and other far-right people the weekend before had come openly armed, some of them with AR-15s and stuff. There was guns pulled, people very seriously hurt. And now that, after the fact, Patriot Prayer is promising to come to town again for another rally, and the Proud Boys are coming for a separate rally, and in their messaging talking about Kyle Rittenhouse, the shooter from Kenosha. And so people are very, very scared that they actually are going to be coming with the intent of using lethal force against protesters.
Let's talk about Kenosha. Although on the other side of the country, this is the new flashpoint around police brutality, around Trump's politicization of his so-called law and order approach to re-election. And you had two people killed there who were active with Black Lives Matter by the 17-year-old white activist who was armed illegally and who idolized police. And one of the videos, one of the most remarkable things that came out of Kenosha that has not received as much attention is a video showing very open collaboration between the police and these armed men. The police literally stopped to ask them if they needed water, made sure they had water, turned around and enforced curfew against some other person, and then turned around and said over a bullhorn, "We really appreciate you guys." This was a police officer saying to these armed vigilantes that Kyle Rittenhouse was a part of. Are you seeing that sort of welcome mat being rolled out to armed white vigilante groups like Patriot Prayer in Portland as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the police violence that police enact themselves is well documented. We're talking about a lot, but there's also the police violence of their disproportionate protection, basically their unwillingness to interfere on white vigilante violence, which has a long historical legacy. So in Portland on August 22nd, when there was the big Patriot Prayer rally and they were attacking people and stuff, this came after 3 months of the police attacking protesters and disrupting any kind of demonstration there was. Like they were not hesitating to use violence, except for when the Proud Boys were doing it. Then they stayed 3 blocks away and refused to intervene.
Wow.
And that seems to be how people are understanding the Portland police here. And it's why a lot of protesters start to believe that the Portland police are sort of acting in their own interests and letting, you know, far-right groups do their dirty work for them. And I don't see any reason to believe that after they did that on the 22nd and how they didn't do anything to stop, you know, the caravan from attacking people the weekend after that, that in the coming weeks when vigilantes are coming, and they are coming, they're promising they're coming, they're advertising and people are coming from around the country, if the Portland police is going to do anything to stop the violence that's going to happen.
Attorney General William Barr and Trump himself have echoed this claim that both of them are making of shadowy anarchists boarding planes and crossing state lines, filling up planes to cause trouble, to make mayhem. They're not giving any details about where this is happening. They're not revealing sources or providing any evidence. But isn't it the armed white vigilantes that seem to be crossing state lines? Kyle Rittenhouse certainly did with a weapon. He came from Illinois.
There's an epidemic of white vigilante violence happening right now. It's happening all across the country. In Philadelphia, people are patrolling the streets with baseball bats attacking protesters. People have been shot and killed all over the country. People are driving cars into protesters. And, you know, Trump and Barr running around with like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about outside agitators. It's absurd. It has no basis in fact. It's actually really hard to even engage with some of this because we're talking about something that's so like off the deep end of logic and reason. So no, there's actual documented evidence of these organizations moving people around. Proud Boys are promising to bring people from around the country to Portland to basically enact the Kyle Rittenhouse fantasy. We know that. That's documented. What's not documented is the idea that, you know, anarchists are raising money, I don't know, with frequent flyer miles to fly into places and throw soup cans. Like this, and the fact that we're even engaging in this itself is a sort of red herring that we've been forced into, that we're having to talk about these protests as if there's some kind of well-funded Antifa operation, when what's happening is they're organic Black Lives Matter anti-racist protests against real documented police violence and white vigilante violence. So we know where they're coming from, we know how they work, and it's just a diversionary tactic to actually turn our attention away from the people who are actually enacting violence and what it's going to take to stop them.
And this is standard Trump, it's the standard Trump playbook. Accuse your enemies, quote unquote, of basically the same violations you are engaged in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's to transpose, culpability onto victims and to make the people who are on the recipients of violence somehow the perpetrators of it. And nothing is further from the fact. And I think that Trump's absolute, like, dyed-in-the-wool commitment to sticking in support of white vigilantes shows exactly how far he's willing to go with this.
There are polls showing that support for Black Lives Matter is falling among white Americans. There was a moment earlier this year when, after the video of George Floyd's brutal killing, there was a broad consensus around the nation that, yes, Black lives do matter, because to police, they clearly don't. And you saw huge support. It became a mainstream rallying cry, even among Republicans. Do you think that these polls suggesting that the support among white Americans for Black Lives Matter falling has to do with Fox News and the Trump folks reorganizing the narrative, rearranging the narrative to paint Black Lives Matter as, quote, Antifa thugs?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, on a long enough time frame, they're able to recontextualize anything with some kind of ideological narrative, even if it's not based in reality. I mean, this is what we saw at the RNC recently, essentially a kind of white panic reaction. A lot of those speeches were really similar to something you would have found in like apartheid South Africa, just trumping up a fear that they're like enemies at the gates, that they're coming to overthrow your way of life, all this kind of stuff. So what they're doing is taking people's kind of shared revulsion at what people are experiencing and just recontextualizing it into a white flight fantasy. And so that's a deep well for the Republican Party. They can always turn back to that. So all this rhetoric about attacking the suburbs, about low-income housing coming into the suburbs, all of this are basically racialized dog whistles. And what they're doing is presenting like two enemies, non-white folks and left-wing protesters, both of which are really scary and going to be attacking kind of affluent whites.
Are you also worried that white liberals are falling for this idea that rioting, vandalizing property is equivalent to or maybe worse than police killing people? We saw Joe Biden, you know, the symbol of the centrist liberal establishment, putting out an ad condemning rioting and saying that it should be prosecuted, and then following that up with saying that, you know, essentially condemning right-wing violence as well. He created this equivalence that that now I think white liberals might fall for.
Yeah, I think it's disturbing, and it has a really it's a really immediate effect of destabilizing any kind of coalition solidarity. But it's also not surprising. I mean, we're talking about people who are actually kind of frightened about the property and their authority being challenged. And so the thing is that these sorts of protests, which are aggressive and militant, all those sorts of things, while not being anywhere comparable to the violence of the police, are really destabilizing communities. They're going after real fundamental problems happening. And if we're going to actually target the fundamentals of what's going on here, that's going to mean a radical change in society. And that's one that frankly doesn't necessarily benefit rich, liberal, Democratic Party holders.
How do you explain to those who might be sitting on the fence why protesters might say burn down a building?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of a historic legacy of what protests actually are. Protests have targeted property for centuries, and that's the kind of the reality about how people in disaffected areas confront power. And it has a long historical legacy that we simply erase when we kind of want to have a particular narrative about things like civil rights and the labor movement and stuff like that. But the reality is that whether or not you like that, this has been an organic part of these protests for a very long time. And the targeting of things like property, whether or not you agree with that, has no direct connection to the kind of violence that's happening to people. You know, people are very scared about things like buildings being torched, but what we're talking about is essentially trash fires in comparison to people having their bones broken by police batons that are, you know, having their bodies kind of react to tear gas, that people are having chemical weapons used against their bodies. These things are not comparable. And so I think this obsessive look at like, oh my God, protesters are breaking windows and that kind of thing, it's really spectacular, but it requires a lot of narrative to actually think that that's somehow equivalent to the violence that's taking place.
Right. I mean, there are actual people being killed that is being eclipsed by buildings being burned and that is or damaged. And that just seems pretty sad to think about. There's also the issue of the hyper-partisanship that the Trump administration is engaging in by saying that it was going to try to defund Democratic-run cities, all of this layered on top of that, Democratic voters being disenfranchised, postal service regarding mail-in ballots to Democratic enclaves and cities being disproportionately targeted. I mean, we have a president, of course, as you pointed out, the RNC, where Trump basically just, you know, used the White House, a taxpayer-funded residence, as a political prop. this, as somebody who's written about fascism, these are all hallmarks of fascism, right?
Yeah, they're definitely concerning. And his ability to kind of centralize power and to actually create a kind of consensus support around something that seems so absurd is really frightening. And I think what's also equally frightening is that the liberal left is willing to kind of play Trump's game, to play to his rhetoric, and to not challenge the fundamental legitimacy of what's happening, to do nothing that really, really fundamentally stops them, which, again, I think speaks to the importance of on-the-ground protests. I mean, people want to know why these protesters are out there instead of talking about Joe Biden and voting. It's because Joe Biden and voting have not stopped Trump. And so right now, people are trying to find like another way of doing that. And they're doing it by building up grassroots movements from the ground up. And I think that is part of why we're hitting close to day 100 in Portland, is the protests don't seem to be stopping, is because there's a real fundamental problem here that a lot of those liberal reforms, the liberal reformers, simply can't do something about.
Right. It's not an accident that a lot of the Democratic-run cities are the ones that are plagued by police brutality. I believe it was the National Association of Police, who had supported Biden in previous presidential runs, have now switched support to Trump. So, you know, there was a time when these police unions were supporting Democrats, and a lot of the Democratic leaders, from mayors to governors, have not done enough, have tried to placate and appease police over and over and over. And it seems as though now we're all paying the price for that.
Yeah, I mean, right now, Oregon Democrats are basically flanking the Republicans from the right. They're supporting increased policing as a solution to the protest, increased charging of protesters. They're doing all those things not because they're being forced to by Republicans. They're doing those things on their own. The aggressive policing didn't start with this protest. It goes back several years of Ted Wheeler's kind of control of the city as essentially a response to increased protests around the Trump administration. So yeah, I mean, what they're doing is they're taking a law and order approach on their own. And so again, what allies do protesters have in any kind of elected office? They have the Democrats that are essentially supporting the police and beating them every night. And then they have the Republicans who are advocating increased beatings every night. So there's really nowhere else to go except to each other.
Finally, let me ask you, Shane, how Portlandians see the protests, those who may not be directly involved in it. Are you seeing a shift, for people who are within the city, who may have friends and family who are participating in the protests or just watching it unroll before their eyes? Are you seeing political persuasions move one way or another toward the protesters, more sympathizing toward the protesters or moving against the protesters?
The protests are generally really popular here in Portland. The movement in general is really popular. Just recently, there was an NAACP march that was very, very popular. I think the idea of nightly protests is a political radical core of folks. Most people aren't going to come out to a protest for months on end every single night and be willing to incur police violence. But the thing is that increases in police violence actually, you'd assume that it would actually decrease participation, but it actually has had the opposite effect. And I think that's because it does actually garner sympathy from the rest of the city. Certainly a lot of people are tired of having roads blocked and the city is literally covered with broken glass and graffiti. And so I think that creates a certain amount of tension. But the reality is that the police have not garnered a lot of sympathy from the rest of the community, and the protesters' demands are sort of reflected in a lot of the politics around the area. Even if they don't go to the full abolition perspective, the idea of defunding the police and creating alternatives to the police is a pretty popular notion here.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Shane, for joining us today and giving us an unfiltered view of what's actually happening in Portland. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
My guest has been Shane Burley, writer and filmmaker based in Portland, Oregon. His work has appeared in Roar magazine, In These Times, Labor Notes, and Makeshift. He's the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. We've been discussing the latest situation unfolding in Portland. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.